A cornucopia of news here on this Tuesday, our first day back live after the Republican state convention and the Democrats as well, Duluth and Rochester respectively. And I did not expect there to be this much news, this much interesting, provocative, impactful news coming out of these conventions, more so the DFL than the Republicans. But there is, and I'm not alone in giving you analysis on it here tonight. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. You can catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop right up. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. You're going to have something really good to contribute to the show during this first hour, because we've got two fantastic guests in with us. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. From the podcast, Kip and Max Save the World, the aforementioned Kip and Max. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Walter.
It's fantastic to have both of you here. Kip, I've known for some time, and Max, I'm meeting you in person here tonight, and I've been catching these episodes. You know, I've been hearing, I remember, actually, I should go back even a little bit further. I remember when you were talking about starting to do a podcast, Kip, and I was just fascinated with the prospect that you might do so. And then I completely lost touch with the whole project, and then started to hear rumors and tremors and echoes of, you know, this Kip and Max Save the World podcast is something that you should be listening to, because they're bringing a type of analysis to the table that is not common. And I checked it out, and I have to agree with that assessment. Is you guys are bringing something to the table that can't really be found elsewhere.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So that's the voice of Kip.
Yes.
And this is the voice of Max.
I am Kip.
And he is Max.
And this is how we start the podcast every time we start.
Which is good.
And ultimately, what we try to do is we try to be very issue-specific. We try to be guest-oriented and get people in who are smarter than we are and pick their brain on any given local topic or any statewide topic that we think might be interesting. And then at the end of the podcast, we call it Kip and Max Save the World, because we always try to include a nugget to take with you and save the world with.
And yeah. Usually we task our guests with providing that if we have a guest. Otherwise, you've got some episodes like today's episode, which will be released later, where it's just the two of us. We really want to hash something out in depth, maybe some different arguments where we disagree or just have a lot to say. Mm-hmm. In that brief, concise, usually half an hour to an hour, that we try to shoot for. We want it to be with brevity and with wit and with some really personal anecdotes, but also some good insight, in ways that'll be beneficial to people that want to understand the inside baseball of Minnesota politics in a more serious, but fun and light way.
And it delivers on all those fronts. The Save the World component, you know, at first I just thought, oh, it's a fancy podcast name. But that actually is the unique value proposition of the show, is that you're attempting to provide practical suggestions or solutions or at least, you know, things that people can do or directions that they can turn themselves in to try to advance past the conversation into something productive tomorrow. And frankly, a lot of productions in this space, the sure. commentary space, are not focused on that at all. It's more about the grouching and the complaining and the provocateuring and what have you. You know, this show included, depending on the night you tune in.
Yep.
And I think that the example you guys are setting of saying, look, no matter what it is we're talking about, and no matter how, you know, sucktastic it may be on any given day, there is something we can take away from it at the end of our consideration that's practical and meaningful and productive that we can do moving forward.
We've been recording for over a year now, just the two of us. Now, not all of that original content we ever aired. We didn't publicize it. We wanted to get the vibe down. We wanted to get a good rapport with each other and make sure that we had something that was worth delivering before we started putting it out, and then made sure that we had some serious content actually developing within that before we started publicizing that we were even doing it. So that we, once we hit the ground, we wanted to hit the ground running with something valuable to our listeners.
And we record in the same studio as we're in right now. So the production quality is pretty high. Usually we have the folks from Justice and Drew helping us produce it. And ultimately we do think, you're right, we're about 50 episodes in, all in, you know, not all of those are online, but if you go to kippandmax.com, you can get a feel for who we are, what we do. We're an easy listen, like I said, half an hour to an hour at the most.
Drive time.
And that's who we are.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of fun doing it.
You know, and if we don't record, if we don't have something meaningful to talk about that week, like it's not the most consistent podcast in the world. We'll sometimes have double headers where we take a guest, divide the segment, put it out as two separate things. Sometimes we just skip a week because, you know, the week was a little dull and we're not going to bore you with that content. There's sure. A lot of other content out there. When we're on, we want to be on right.
Well, that makes it very bingeable. If you're in a situation like myself, or no doubt many of the listeners tonight, and you haven't been following it, you know, week after week, you can go back and listen to the episodes right now congruently, and it's all solid content, likely in no small part due to that discriminatory taste that you guys are employing.
Thank you.
All right, so enough about the podcast itself. Let's talk about what you've been talking about on the podcast. Now, the episode that caught my attention and made me want to have you guys on so that we could hash the subject matter out was a couple of weeks back, you did a preview of the state conventions, both the Republican and Democrat state conventions that were forthcoming. And during that discussion, there was some commentary from each of you regarding this concept of effective principles when it comes to, you know, in a convention process, you're deciding who we're going to endorse as a party in order to go forth into the battlefield of the general election or even the primary and attempt to become the next whatever, governor, U.S. senator, state representative,
right,
what have you. And that setting provides a context where there's broadly speaking two different points of view. One is let's win, right? Let's win
at all costs.
At all costs, no matter what the case may be, and whatever we have to sacrifice in order to get there, because winning is just too darn important.
Well, isn't losing sacrificing though too?
Well, like, and that's what we're getting towards. Is the other perspective is no, it has to be about the principles. It has to be about what we're trying to actually accomplish, and if the people we're putting forward aren't good enough, then we should not be supporting them, which leads to what you just said, Kip, which is this concept of effective principles.
Yeah, and we can be as principled as we want to be, but at the end of the day, if we can talk, in wonderful idealistic terms about what the ideal government would be, and my political philosophy professors from college would love to have me talk about those things. But we also live in the real world. We live in the real world where governance happens in a dirty way, where power does influence the outcomes of our daily lives. And we, Max and I, believe along with you that we should, as individuals, have more autonomy, more control over our lives, more control of those decisions in our lives. And one of the ways to do that is to be in the position where we can actually control how government impacts us. And if we are the people that ran our butts off but lost, we don't control crap.
Sure. There is no second place in these races.
Yeah. But at the same time, and I think this is where Kip and I differentiate a little bit, where Kip is much more winning focused, where I think I'm probably a little bit more of an ideologue when it comes to policy and things that we want to execute on once we get into office. One thing that this past year's election proved to me in 2016 specifically was it was like, well, darn it all, I don't know if I support Donald Trump, because on the front end, he doesn't look like a guy that I would ever support. So in that dynamic, winning isn't everything to me. My wife had to convince me to vote for the guy. But now I look at some of the, and I don't want to make this too much about Donald Trump specifically.
Right. But he's a very good example of what we're talking
about. The fruit that has come from him being elected has proven me wrong 100-fold. So what am I supposed to do with that?
Right.
Yeah, that's, I'd be interested in delving into that particular example at some future time, because sure, that'll take a whole segment itself.
You're right.
We've got a lot to cover.
I want to get at, you know, just some basic philosophical responses to what you said on your podcast, which is basically what you just reiterated, which, you know, put in a simplified way. What we're saying is you can't do anything if you don't win. It doesn't matter how great your ideas are. If you can't win, then they're never going to affect public policy. They're never actually going to end up governing your life. And you're going to be subject to whatever the other side wants. And this translates to what is commonly called the lesser of two evils argument, right? Because when you're presented with a Donald Trump or a similar candidate who, for a certain segment of the party, rubs them the wrong way on specific policy or even overall ideological disposition, you're asking people to accept something that they do not agree with, perhaps even vigorously disagree with, on the basis that it's better than the alternative. In this case,
that's right,
Trump is better than Hillary.
Right.
My question for you is there a point past which the effective principles, meaning principles you can actually implement, become so diluted that they no longer really have any merit? They don't longer have, they're no longer worth winning with, because they're not, they don't resemble why you got into this business in the first place.
Yeah, that's a very real existential crisis that I think a lot of politicos do have to deal with. And those of us with the mindset that is so much more construed towards the victory and towards what is the play five moves from now.
Mm-hmm.
When you're trying to set that sort of stuff up, you realize that politics is a game with humans, and humans change, and you can't plan out the system in that sort of a way. From a strategy standpoint, you can't predict every move, but also from a principles standpoint, it's also a game of humans. And there is a check and balance internally with that system, that if you put up someone who might be the most on paper likely person to win, but they don't excite or mobilize anybody to help them do that,
mm-hmm,
and people don't vote for them.
Yeah, you talked about this with the Senate endorsement that was...
There's your check.
Yeah, right.
I think it's a natural, just like a market principle, where if you raise your price too high or the demand falls, like it works exactly the same way.
Bingo.
In politics.
Hmm. And when you achieve when you finally achieve that power, when you finally achieve that victory, if for so long, because we can have hardcore activists rag against the quote unquote establishment, both
right,
at the state level and the federal level, the ultimate dictate of how well you are doing or how well your principles are being implemented comes from a market philosophy of voting, where those people will become cynical and they will stay home. It happens.
Or they'll primary you and you kick you out.
And that's in the most extreme case.
So right, am I hearing you say, and we do have to go to a break here pretty quick, but am I hearing you say that voters, activists, are actually pricing themselves out of the market to where they've set a threshold?
A lot of people already have.
Yeah. And this is the kind of removing your consent wing of activism, and also the people who are involved, but they're setting a standard, you know, AJ Kern comes to mind,
yep,
setting a standard that's so outside the scope of the mainstream that nobody else is going to be with you over there.
You can put up a product that no one wants to buy that sustains you for a little while, but it's going to eventually fail.
Fascinating. I need to take a break just to chew on that. Closing argument, we got Kip and Max in from Kip and Max Save the World. You can find it at kipandmax.com. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream us. Got Kip and Max in studio with us. Their podcast is called Kip and Max Save the World, and that's not just clever marketing, folks. They actually try in every episode to offer some sort of practical response to the subject matter that they're discussing, kipandmax.com is where you can find it. We've been talking about their show, about their approach to podcasting, which I believe provides a pretty unique value proposition. And we've also been getting to one of the topics that they discussed recently, which was when they were previewing the state conventions, Republican and Democrat, that were forthcoming. They got into talking about activists and endorsement contests and primaries and the dynamic that takes place within a political party between the quote grassroots unquote and the quote establishment unquote. And this one of the concepts that they kind of fleshed out was this idea of effective principles, meaning that it's all well and good as we do on this program every night. You know, the nice thing about having a radio show is that I'm only accountable to me. Nobody has ever, I've never gotten a single memo from anybody at iHeart telling me what I'm supposed to say and what I'm not supposed to say. And the things that I choose to discuss and how I choose to discuss them have no consequences for anybody on this show. That's not true when you're running for office. And it's certainly not true once you're elected and you're actually in office.
Right.
And so I'm free to express whatever principles I so desire in whatever manner I so desire. And as activists, we want that because, you know, the reason why I'm involved as an activist is to get those principles deployed into public policy. And so my mechanism for doing that is finding candidates who will support those principles. And the point that you guys are making is, look, you're never going to find that person. You're never going to hit that bullseye. It's very rare that you're going to hit that bullseye. And so you need to be focused on the concept of having effective principles, meaning the person's able to get elected who has who matches with you to some degree, some tolerable degree, and that's better than the alternative. Am I getting this right?
Democrats believe in unicorns of policy, and some of them just actual unicorns.
Right.
We believe in unicorns.
Unicorn is a gender now, if you didn't know.
Lordy. Republicans tend to seem to believe in unicorn candidates. Hmm. And just like the left's policy ideas don't work, unicorn candidates don't exist. And so we need to go with, because even your perfect, imagine in your mind who is your perfect candidate. There's something about them that you don't know that, you
right.
know, they're
sure.
going to betray you
they're
at some
a human
time,
being.
Especially if you get some emotional attachment to this person. When that betrayal comes, it's going to really sting. And that's where some of the most illogical reasons for people turning on candidates come from.
So I have two questions I want to hit before we have to go to another short break.
Yep.
And the first one is, you know, if in fact candidates and incumbents come to know or come to expect or perceive that you are willing to make certain sacrifices in order to win, in order to have the majority, in order to secure all three branches of government, what leverage then do you have to quote unquote hold them accountable if they believe you're going to support them so long as the other guys are worse?
You want to take that one, Max?
Well, it's a great question. It really is. And again, before we went to break last time, we really covered the market principles of the electorate. And that is to say, you can have loud and noisy activists. I consider myself one of those loud and noisy activists who call for accountability to our candidates. Ultimately, there is a snowball effect that if you don't serve your market and you don't serve them often enough and at large enough, that market will turn on you. That's what our entire podcast was about. So you have certain groups in the state that call for conservative accountability, and they're pretty loud, and they come out with scorecards and things of that nature to show you who your candidates are from their perspective. But ultimately, if the market doesn't decide that you're not good enough to be in that office anymore, then you are serving them to the best of your ability. I really think about, you know, in my neck of the woods, Senate District 49, when I ran for House, the guy who ran opposite of me, Dario Anselmo, he's in 49A. Most people would consider, I mean, he would not be a Republican in many different Senate districts, depending on where you're located. However, he votes for the speaker and he serves the district very well. And guess what? He keeps getting endorsed, you know? So it's one of those things where that electorate and that group of people in Senate District 49 have an understanding of who he is, who they are, and who their audience is and what kind of Republican can get elected in Edina these days.
I've been involved in local party activism for quite a while at this point in my brief life. And we have the ability to become very big-headed about what is the proper perfect candidate within our own realm of existence, right? So in Wright County, where Walter and I reign from, we might have an ideal candidate that is very different than a candidate in Hennepin or a candidate in Lake County. And we have a problem there because when we constrain everybody under this market concept, this concept of a market of politics, we also have a statewide platform. And when the platform gets bloated, the things that we have to keep people accountable to do not necessarily fit those districts. Mm-hmm. And those local activists have the discretion at a certain point, a prosecutorial discretion, if you will,
right,
to go after people for breaking the platform. But if we kept a platform much simpler, much more straightforward and grounded in basic principles, we would provide our districts with a little bit more flexibility to actually elect candidates as Republicans who would vote for the speaker and be in line with us to help advance a statewide agenda potentially more readily, that maybe don't align with the principles of a different county, but help advance the cause as a whole. And I think under the market, we break it. It's almost like a regular, if we want to talk about market principles as conservatives, it's like undue regulations on a small business that has a complete different operating principle than rural Kentucky.
No doubt. And our state party platform has little things in there about Guantanamo Bay.
And it's absurd.
This is what we believe about Guantanamo Bay as a state party. And that's why I've been an advocate for simplifying the platform. I think we both are, so that more or less the rule becomes, if you agree with me 51% of the time, I want you on my team.
There's a brand of activists, and a lot of them are my friends, mm-hmm. and I maybe have even teeter-tottered over into their realm on a time or two.
Sure.
But there is a brand of activists that have come to believe that if you can, through some sort of parliamentary maneuver or the passage of a resolution or something, that you can make other people, which this is the irony of being a libertarian, right? You can make other people agree with you by passing a resolution or by winning a rules fight at a convention. There is no shortcut to convincing people you're right. And people try to take these, because it's politics and because power is a dynamic that's involved, they try to annex the minds of their fellow conservatives, their fellow activists, their fellow delegates and what have you, through these artificial mechanisms without actually going through the trouble of convincing them, no, this is the right thing to do, this is the right position to take. And it comes to my mind, and we're going to have to go to a break here because I knew this was going to happen and we're going to get too robust in our conversation here, but it occurs to me that there are three distinct perspectives that come into conflict as we're trying to price mm-hmm. where we should be, you know, using this market analogy. Sure. The first is the activists, what the activists expect of both their candidates and their incumbents once they're elected. The second is how candidates campaign and how incumbents communicate about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And the third is what's actually required to accomplish something when you're in elected office. They're like tectonic plates that rub against each other, those three things,
and yes, create in all brutal kinds
of friction. And the question that I want to present to you guys, and I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to think about it, is how do we reduce the tension and the conflict between those three forces, activists, campaigning, and actually governing? Closing argument, Kip and Max Save the World is the podcast, kipandmax.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Twin Cities News Talk. Doc. On the right side of the political spectrum, we're constantly talking about markets and the virtue of thinking of issues in market terms. And yet, it seems as though it's not very frequent that as activists, particularly within the context of the Republican Party, when it comes to trying to push our principles through policy or work our way through endorsement fights or primary contests, or even in the general election when we're trying to make our case to the general public, that we take a market approach to that task, you know, trying to look at what does the market want? What does the voter want? and how can we package our ideals, our principles, our policy prescriptions in such a way as that it meets the needs of the market. That's what we've been talking about with here tonight with Kip and Max from the podcast Kip and Max Save the World, which you can find at kipandmax.com. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing Argument is the name of the show. So we left off having identified this kind of tectonic friction that takes place between three distinct forces, as I see it. And there may be other forces that I'm not accounting for, but off the top of my head, there's the activist perspective where you got folks who turn out to caucus, who become delegates, who involve themselves in various volunteer organizations, all with the effort of trying to influence public policy through the party process and the electoral process. And they have a certain set of expectations in terms of what it is they want to see done through government. The second layer, the second perspective that I see is the perspective of the candidate, whether it's an incumbent or somebody who's coming in the process brand new, in terms of how they sell what it is that they're going to do if elected. This is what I'm going to do for you. This is the problem. Here's my prescribed solution. Here's what you're getting if you vote for me. And then the third layer, perhaps the most mysterious, is what it actually takes in institutional reality to accomplish anything at all once you're elected, once you're in the office. And it occurs to me that there's a lot of friction and a lot of cognitive dissonance between those three layers that causes a lot of the problems that you guys find yourself talking about on Kip and Max. First, your insight on that mental picture, and then also, do you have any sense of what we could do to reduce that tension?
Just running a service business, it is always interesting how there is this dynamic between what you sell and the service you sell, and then how you're going to fulfill the work, which in and of itself is an entirely different thing in some cases than what you sell. And that's not by nature of the fact that you might be lying, but you sell yourself a certain way and then you fulfill your work a certain way. And it's about setting, I think, expectations to a certain extent while still maintaining value in what it is you're selling. So that shift, that conflict between what you say trying to get elected, who you're trying to influence, and then what you do while you're in office, it is this healthy balance. But again, I think that the market, your electorate, punishes you if those expectations are not met, at least to a certain extent. And it's what we've talked about. I think it bears itself out a little bit.
In the entrepreneurial and tech world, you, Max, can step in and say, okay, client, what do you want? Sure, I can do that. I've never done this before.
Of course.
I have no idea what
yes.
I'm doing.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I'll provide that service. It doesn't work that way in politics. It doesn't work that way in the actual legislative process. This is an old iceberg that's been sitting there glaciating for years, and it moves very slowly. And there is a defined process for how things work. And you hear candidates promise things off the bat all the time, especially when they're early.
Mm-hmm.
They make a lot of early promises based on the naivete of a new candidate to the political world who hasn't ever served any time, in local government even, who are new to the system, who think that they can just get things through because now they see it through the eyes of a voter. They see it through the eyes that we've been conditioned to see how the legislative process works. These people can just do things.
Right.
And it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I saw that exact thing happen at the last municipal election in my hometown. I serve on a city council in Albertville. And some of the candidates who were seeking office last time around, 2016, were making those types of impossible promises. We're going to increase funding to X, Y, and Z, you know, parks, roads, whatever it is, and we're going to lower your taxes. You know, we're going to keep that small town feel that you want in this town, but we're also going to somehow increase development and bring wonderful new things in here for you to do and make sure you have every different version of a restaurant chain that is personally convenient to you in here. All these things cannot happen at the same time. And I wrote an op-ed to that effect of, look, I don't question these people's sincerity, but let's remember as we're considered, because I wasn't running at the time, I was in the middle of my term, so I could say this. Let's remind ourselves that there are choices that have to be made.
Right.
And so when I talk about the tension between these three levels, the activists, the campaigns, and then what it takes to actually govern, part of what I see is a potential way to manage this is you're not going to change people's expectations, and you shouldn't try. Like, running against the voters is a horrible idea. But we and, you know, I'm thinking people who are in a position to know, the people who are there, the incumbents, or what have you, they know what they can accomplish and what they can't. They know what it takes in order to get something done. And so the choice in how to campaign, how to sell what you're offering to those people, there has to be a through line there between how do I promise something? What do I promise? And do so in a way that I know I can deliver. And also managing expectations in terms of what's going to be required. Because if you're running as a state representative, you're going to need a majority of your peers in the caucus and people from the other side potentially to agree with whatever it is that you're trying to do. So it's not enough just to elect you. You got to be able to elect a majority or hope that there's a reasonable, that the idea has bipartisan appeal.
Here's the fundamental difference between Democrat districts and Republican districts, even at the local municipal level that you point out. Your district had a conflict in that people wanted to say that they were pledging to provide services and also had the institutional check of a population that wanted lower taxes. If you live in a place where raising taxes is not a problem for your electability, you can run as a Democrat and say, I'm going to provide these services and I'm going to raise taxes to do it. And there's no problem from the actual implementation and being someone who fulfills on your promises, being an incumbent. You don't run up against that same institutional problem that you may in a more conservative district.
Right.
And this is how that ball of wax gets built out so bigly, to use our president's terminology.
Right. In Minnesota, I think that to the extent that we're talking about these three elements that comprise a political candidate and then essentially an elected official, there is one person in Minnesota who is in kind of a swing congressional district that I believe is doing this masterfully well. And it's on Kip's shirt. I think Jason Lewis does a phenomenal job of talking the talk. He gets a standing ovation no matter where he goes, be it kind of a Tea Party event or more of a formal party function. The difference between appeasing the activists, it is inherently an emotional thing. It's being able to connect with them and their concerns on a very real level, and it's not BSing them.
Right.
But Jason Lewis and Eric Paulson, for instance, those two, right? I mean, similar districts. Eric's is probably a little bit more liberal in general. Their voting record, there's differences, no doubt about it, but their voting record in general is very similar. I mean, they govern very similarly for the two posts that they were elected to. The way that Jason Lewis talks and connects with that activist delegate voter base is much different than the way somebody like Eric Paulson does, which is why you have almost between hardcore activists a loving relationship with Jason Lewis and then almost an antagonistic relationship with a guy like Eric Paulson is not necessarily because of their voting records themselves. It's because one is able to really connect with those people and make them feel like they're part of the process and he hears their concerns and can speak to them. And then one doesn't do as great of job doing that. I think Jason Lewis balances those three elements very well.
Communicates very well and sets expectations very well.
Yeah, we're overdue to get Congressman Lewis on the program. I would love to posit this question to him and get his take on it. I'm sure he would have some thoughts. Kip and Max Save the World is the name of the podcast. Kip and Max are in studio with us right now. You can check it out at kipandmax.com. One more segment with them when we come back. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, twincitiesnewstalk.com. So I said this was going to be the last segment that we had with Kip and Max, but we had a little talking to during the segment. They took me back to the back by the woodshed, and we're going to have them on for a little bit longer. Kip and Max Save the World. Kip and Max in studio with us. KipandMax.com is where you can find their podcast.
We're on iTunes. We're on Google Play. We're on every platform you can possibly imagine. You go to that website.
If you take your tinfoil hat off, you can also hear us that way.
All right. There we go. This show is called Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Let's go to the phones. Mike in Farmington, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I hope I can get to this as concisely as I can, but some of the things you guys have been talking about over the last half hour or 45 minutes just kind of been firing through my mind, where it basically kind of the business of politics, or and where it seems like it's so business-driven now. They know exactly what they want to do and who they want to reach. And I don't know who the gentleman who brought up Jason Lewis, but I'm a huge fan of Jason, and I listened to his show for years. And his clarity of thought and how he brings these ideas to the fore. I mean, you can understand what he's talking about. But getting back to the business model, I've often wondered where the taxpayers and the people who do the heavy lifting that go out and earn the money, they're like the stockholder. And what I've often wondered is, how are these people that don't produce anything, that basically are getting entitlements and subsidies? I mean, if you're a band or anything and you bring anything to market, you know, you got to play the right songs or the product. But it seems that he who has the gold maybe is not ruling. It's how is it that these people have become so empowered that really I don't see them as being a productive class of people, but they seem to carry the day. And I often wonder, when is this going to fall on its face? And I'll just go to Ayn Rand for a bit. The John Galt, where the producers just basically say, I'm out. And you hear people talking now, I don't even vote anymore.
Yeah.
It says, there's a lot of that. Worth voting.
I appreciate the call, Mike. I have my own sense of an answer to that, but I want to give Kip and Max an opportunity to take a shot at it. Thanks for calling,
Mike. I don't know if you listened to the closing episode of Jason Lewis's radio show. I was working a campaign at the time, and I was listening to him regularly. And when he decided to go Galt, it struck home. Because there was a certain sense of just discouragement with the system that he had been fighting for over the airwaves for so long. When you get discouraged like that, what did he do? He started building a machine that could carry him to Congress. We need to have an optimistic response to that discouragement when it comes, when it befalls us, that builds itself out into action. And we need to think about that clearly and concisely and with principles, yes, but also with the business of politics. There is a process. There is a fundamental way to attain the reins of power and influence and build for ourselves the world which we desire. And I think Jason, in whatever way he came to it, built a pretty good path for himself after he had that closing episode and went Galt.
You mentioned something there almost in passing that I think is absolutely critical, and that's optimism. And this is something that over the year and change that we've had this program, this is the great revelation, the great gift that this program has given me, is in being, having my nose stuck in the news day after day, to an extent that's, you know, perhaps unhealthy in order to be able to prep for this show. First of all, the only way I can survive that process is by having a sense of optimism. So there's just the practical necessity of it. But it also, coincidentally and conveniently, happens to be a beneficial and truthfully necessary orientation in order to do anything productive moving forward. If you lose hope, then there's nowhere, you don't have any prescription in terms of where you should go next.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that the only way to be optimistic is by being a good little Republican and doing whatever the party tells you to do, but it is to say that you have to have something. When Lewis quit the radio, he had something else, some other path that he was looking to take.
And sometimes you have to force yourself to be optimistic,
right,
even when you don't feel like it.
And I have thoughts on this, too, because you mentioned going Gault. That's what Jason Lewis did. To a certain extent, John Gault is not a character to envy.
To emulate, either.
We will expound upon that and get into the news from the conventions over the weekend when we return. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson. Kip and Max in studio, kipandmax.com. Kip and Max save the world. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Conversation tonight with Kip and Max, their podcast, Kip and Max Save the World. You can find out more about it at kipandmax.com, or you can subscribe to their podcast through whatever platform you prefer. It's available wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can stream us on twincitiesnewstalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. You can catch up on past shows by doing a search for a Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop right up. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Olman takes those calls and produces the show. Let's talk to Dan in Minnetonka. He's been holding for quite some time. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. You got a great voice for radio.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
You know, I've been thinking about this, and it kind of hit me after having listening to you. You know, we are like frogs in warming water that's growing in temperature. And all around us, certainly it's been obvious, our educational institutions, the media, local media, national media, et cetera, is pushing toward a leftist, stupid, socialist way of life for Americans, and with an uneducated populace who don't know the Constitution and why the Constitution and following it is extremely important for our very existence, you know, the protection of our republic, I'm afraid that we're all getting boiled, and we don't know it. And you mentioned about finding out what the market wants. How about we persuade the market what is best through intelligent argument? You know, I think that's the real scary part. I don't see Paulson doing that. I see that he's always just kind of on the defensive, and every time on TV, I don't see him standing up for why constitutional principles is the best for everyone, rich or poor. The cost of government, the way it's going absolutely nuts at every level, driving elderly people basically out of their homes with rising property taxes and sales taxes. You know what I'm saying? I think that's the remedy. The remedy is engagement. And I committed today, or actually yesterday, to join Jeff Johnson because I see him as some...
We need to be happy warriors. You're exactly right. We need to communicate better.
And, you know, we need to educate ourselves and really get into the fray. None of us have the time, because it's difficult to make the time.
Right.
Particularly conservatives, because our life is not politics. For the leftists, it is their life. That's their religion. This is what they do that, you know, trips their trigger.
Well, it's. I think that's all true. I think it's also true that it's their business as well as everything else. That's how they make their money. I appreciate the call, Dan. This is a point that Nick Morgan, the newly elected chair of the Minnesota Young Republicans, has raised, that Republicans need to find a way to, and this kind of runs counter to certain grassroots activist instincts, but Republicans need to find a way to professionalize the party structure and the larger community around the party. There needs to be places like parking spots, mm-hmm. metaphorically, where people can go to make money and to keep busy and to develop their skills and qualifications for the next opportunity they have to run for office or be a staffer or whatever the case may be.
In most other states, that's just called party building. And it is a portion that is that is there and constant and secure, and people can have a career in it and be effective in it.
Right.
Here, most of that is done either on the outside. The party has just been in a poor position where we can't do that party building activity. Now, to one of his points, why can't we sell that message better? I'd like to cycle that right back to our previous conversation about why some of the activists who want us to vote harder and go in that direction and push the party platform and try to get all of these resolutions pushed through. I find that a lot of that happens when people feel discouraged with trying to share their message and find it falls on deaf ears. And so they try to then take up the reins of power and force people to believe what they believe.
Yeah, right.
which always works.
You're doing it wrong, buddy. Yeah. If you can't persuade people of what you're convicted of, it's not that you're wrong.
You know, I wasn't with you on raw milk, but since you passed your resolution, I've reconsidered my position.
That's right.
I've got to follow you.
Yeah.
You know, I guess, well, I'm so much a Republican, I'm going to believe now something that I don't previously believe.
Right. Yeah.
But that's not how this works.
Right.
But if we do believe that what we believe is the correct path, what mm-hmm. we believe is the truth.
Right.
We should be able to articulate that if it's something we've honestly thought about in ourselves. And if we can't articulate that even to our closest friends,
mm-hmm.
what is it that we actually believe?
Right.
I've run into these scenarios in my role on the city council where there are questions that have come before me where my libertarian Tea Party activist instincts are to go in a very different direction than what's being proposed. But I can't sell that. I can't sell it to my fellow council members, and I can't even sell it to my constituents who I was elected to serve because they're in a different headspace than I am.
Right.
They're perceiving a different value and have a different expectation of what they're supposed to be getting from their municipal government than what I have through my very particular ideological lens. And so in those situations, I'm presented with a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Do I fight for my cause to no avail? Like, I'm not going to get what I want. I'm not going to convince people that what I wanted was a good idea, right?
You don't have a legislative majority.
Yeah, I've got nothing to achieve.
Yeah.
Or do I concede this point and wait for the next opportunity to where the context is more acclimated towards making progress in the right direction? And this is a choice that every elected official makes in whatever capacity that they're serving.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who tell you they don't are lying, right? Because
yes.
they all have had to deal with budgets, deal with levies, deal with taxes and what have you. And the guy who, if there's a guy out there who's voting no on everything, he's the guy who everybody hates and who is probably not going to get reelected because he's not providing the service that people expect out of their elected official.
There are other people in Minnesota who talk a lot about politics who say that the mantra that the art of legislation is conciliation and compromise mm-hmm. is wrong.
Right.
It's exactly the art of legislation.
That's not a philosophical statement. That the art of politics is conciliation and compromise is not a philosophical statement.
No, no, no.
It's an objective observation of reality.
Right.
That's what it is.
Right.
Because it's the institution is structured in such a way that you have to come to a compromise
right.
in order to achieve literally anything.
And frankly, Walter, if you take the position you just said where I sit this one out, you have lost. You've lost the opportunity to compromise and attempt to draw other people to come to your position. Now, I realize in the position you're in, it might not matter to them and they might not have any incentive to compromise with you and come
right.
your direction.
Right.
But if the choice that activists I often see make is, and sometimes legislators at the State House, if you make the choice to, I'm just going to sit this one out with my arms crossed and frump over here in the corner, you're losing, buddy.
Right.
And to that end, one of the people that I supported during the presidential election was Ted Cruz. You know, well, I like Ted Cruz because I think he aligned with my beliefs. You know, to the rawest extent, I believed that he believed the same things that I did. hardcore activist here, by the way. And you heard from every other one of his colleagues. I mean, what was it? John Boehner.
No one liked working with
him. He was the most miserable son of a bee that he's ever encountered.
Sure.
You know, and it's that type of thing where you're not productive when you're constantly sitting on the sidelines. But I wanted to also address before what you guys were talking about, where if an idea is compelling enough, it's compelling enough to stand on its own. That's why our friends on the left are going to have an issue for a long, long time until their attitude changes, because it has become a legislative morality the way that they view the world. At least the activist left, the loud left.
Right. And more and more the elected left.
Yes.
Yes.
It's legislate morality, and that's never compelling to a human being. It's as old as the gospel itself. Do you force or impose your will on somebody else, or do you allow your idea to be so irrefutably compelling that they come to you?
It's
a tale as old as time, and the left are going to get it wrong. I mean, that is why they will continue to suffer, in my opinion, electoral defeats, because they have become the party that legislates morality on people and want to see words shut down. They want to see activity shut down that they're uncomfortable with. That's not a compelling message for anybody.
They become neo-puritanical.
Yeah,
in a very real sense.
Of course, of course. And we used to be there. I mean, the right and left, we battle back, and this is what happens when you obtain power, but we battle back and forth on how we want to wield that power, how we want to try to, you know, if it was the Holy Rollers in the 1970s, you know, and then even prior to that, that's what the 60s were about and rebelling against the establishment, and where you saw kind of the hippie culture come from. In a very similar sense, you're seeing a Generation Z now today rebel against their teachers who are trying to police their language, who are telling them that there is more than two genders and they need to abide by that. And there's lots of different dynamics to this. But if an idea is compelling enough on its own, you don't have to legislate it.
Ideas cannot be imposed. They must be cultivated.
Ooh.
And if you don't keep that in mind, you're never going to see it grow.
Yeah, I agree.
We've already talked about Jason Lewis tonight, but one of the things he used to say to illustrate that point is he pointed to the speed limit. He's like, look, there's a speed, a prevalent speed, that people are going to go.
Yeah.
And we all know it because we all drive it and we all see everybody else driving it. And it isn't always necessarily in sync with what the state tells us the speed limit ought to be. And there is a point past which, and the state's aware of this as well, that they are aware of the fact that there is they can set it to a point where nobody will obey it at all, where nobody will even come close to obeying it because it's unreasonable for the circumstances.
On the Kitty Freeway in St. Paul.
Yeah, that's right. It's it's out of sync with, yeah, I know exactly the stretch you're talking about. It's out of sync with what Brad referred to or exposed us to as bounded rationality. Was that the concept, Brad?
Yes.
Bounded rationality, meaning the judgment that the individual makes given the specific circumstances that he finds himself in, if your rule is out of sync with that, nobody's going to follow that rule.
Bingo. Yes.
Closing argument. My name's Walter Hodson. Kip and Max in studio with us. KipandMax.com is where you can find their podcast. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Come with me now. Come with me now.
All right. We've got to get to all this news coming out of the conventions over the weekend. We got Kip and Max in studio with us. Their podcast, Kip and Max Save the World. You can find it at kipandmax.com. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing Argument, the name of our program. Before we get into all that news, we want to talk to David and Woodbury real quick, and then we'll move along. How you doing, David?
Fine, thank you. Just as a general comment, family, friends, we see all this weird stuff going on in the news, all this untruth being perpetrated against humanity and people in this country, you know, with the news broadcasts and everything else. And we get frustrated because it's discouraging not seeing that people want to be honest and true, at least a portion of our population. And as I'm discussing this stuff with my family, the conclusion that I've come to and they have is, we we've got to recognize it, be aware of it, and talk about it amongst ourselves and those people that are willing to listen. And then the next thing is to be on our knees praying about it, because it's really in God's hands at some point. You know, if we're willing to be instruments and be used in that manner, then he's going to do whatever he feels he needs to do. So that's my comment.
I appreciate your thoughts, David. All right, so from the Star Tribune, news that our listeners are probably no doubt aware of, but it's definitely got to begin our review of the outcomes from the weekend. Republican Jeff Johnson and Democrat Aaron Murphy won their primary endorsement Saturday as candidates for Minnesota governor, but both now face tough primary battles against former Governor Tim Pawlenty and U.S. Representative Tim Walz. Now, that opening paragraph, that opening statement is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of all the stuff that took place, particularly on the DFL side in Rochester this weekend. What are your guys' hot takes on these convention results and endorsement results?
So many hot takes. We have 11 people running for Congressional District 5 as of today, who filed today. Between the conventions that happened and today, I think most people who have been in politics for a long time in this state would tell you it's been the craziest 4 or 5 days maybe ever.
I've heard that from the old timers, like the oldest of old timers. Like, this is... I've never seen, there was a delegate I was talking to, I've never seen his eyes this bright as when I talked to him today. Like, whoa, what just happened?
What is going on?
It's crazy. So we've got a lot of shakeup post convention, but also during the convention with the DFL. Let's put a pin in this. Republican convention really came out like there's very little contest going on, no real serious candidates in the primaries except for the gubernatorial race. So that's kind of where we're at.
Right.
You know, Bob bites back, but I don't think he's going to bite very hard in the primary.
He made a very Bob Anderson made a very good showing at the convention.
He came in third.
Yeah, I was impressed by his presentation overall.
All that Rebecca Brannon really professionalized it.
Yeah, she's pretty good at what she does. All that to be said, I think that there were not many surprises at the GOP convention. You did have a contingent of what we can call Pawlenty kind of people who were trying to work for a no endorsement, it felt like. That was pretty much squashed right away. And Jeff, by the third ballot, it was becoming very apparent that Jeff was going to secure the nomination. And then, to their credit, you had both Phil Parrish and Mary Giuliani Stevens. You know, they relinquished their spot pretty early on, and they all supported Jeff.
Well before the 60% was actually reached numerically.
Right. And so Kip and I have talked about this. If I were Mary, I would just like to see what would happen on one more ballot. However, the unity that came away from that convention, pretty impressive. You know, we still have the Tim Pawlenty factor where Jeff is going to have a really challenging time. But all that to be said, it was a pretty fun time. Not a ton of hostility, not a ton of drama.
Right.
And then you look at the other side of the aisle, and it was the exact opposite of that.
I can't even off the top of my head list it all off. I mean, I should have made myself a little flow chart.
I can give you a shot.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the DFL primary, the DFL convention, our conventions have very different convention personalities. So we can look at it from the outside and think that it was absolutely insane, while there are DFLers I've spoken to since convention who said that this was one of the most clearly run stable conventions with known process, well-run, good parliamentarians that they've ever seen. That being said, here's what happened. You had, so early on, you had the senators' races. You had Tina Smith against Richard Painter as the big dust-up in the Senate side. Painter came with a serious populist message. He was really angry. He was, like, just from a little blip I got of him, but he's going to be a serious challenge against Tina Smith going into the primary. He has the capacity to raise a lot of money, has forced Tina Smith into much more of a fundraising operation than she ever thought she was going to be at this stage, and has really put her on her heels going into the primary, because this is a guy with like 200,000 Twitter followers in Minnesota based on his analytics, based on his campaigns, his Twitter follower analytics. Like, this guy has a serious following. He's on MSNBC and CNN. Crazy thing there. Amy Klobuchar really has no serious contest. Now we get into the rest of the races. Steve Simon, unopposed for endorsement. He's going to be the Secretary of State candidate from the DFL going forward. Attorney General was kind of a shakeup. So you've got Lori Swanson, current Attorney General, who was running against Matt Pelican. Pelican took like 48-something percent against Lori Swanson's above 50%. And Lori Swanson dropped out of consideration for the nomination, carrying over 50% into the endorsement.
And I want to pause on that. Think about that. A sitting attorney general was not losing the endorsement, but did not get endorsed on the first ballot.
And dropped out.
So what
that's incredible.
What are the theories on what motivated that?
I think she had an internal algorithm in her head that she was either going to run for governor if things looked like they were going to go against Tim Walz or something of that nature. And if she didn't have a resounding, yes, Lori, we want you. We want you so much to be our attorney general again. If she didn't have that, she wasn't going to do it. She's kind of like Amy Klobuchar in one very small way. They're both prima donnas, and they want to have the spotlight, and they want to make sure that that is there. So Lori Swanson drops out of consideration for AG and goes and gets her spotlight elsewhere. So you've got AG goes down. We've got on the auditor side, you've got Blaha against Tollefson. Tollefson is going to take it to the primary. Blaha comes out of the union background. She got endorsement. They're going forward to primary.
But her last name is Blaha, so you know she's not going anywhere.
Blaha.
It's a terrible last name.
No, but
Blaha.
She's a serious operator, kind of a union jackbooted thug type person, but
I honestly thought you were just using like a filler, like a variable.
No, that was
that's her last name.
That was not verbal filler.
She's okay. Going to lose. Blaha. That's terrible.
Anyway, we shouldn't dunk like this. Anyway, so going on, we've got there's our constitutional offices. Now we get to governor. And governor is crazy because you've got Tim Walz with Peggy Flanagan, who looked like out of the gate, this was going to be absolutely the way that the smart money would go, right? So you've got Tim Walz with Peggy. They've got by far a massive chip lead in the campaign finance world. And then you've got Rebecca Otto, who just fired her campaign manager earlier that week. And you've got Aaron Murphy, who kind of is coming in as this quiet dark horse. And there's a little bit of inside politics as to how she did this, but she was racking up endorsements like crazy while Otto was slipping, and Tim Walz was kind of hitting back and forth with matching union endorsements and endorsements from people like, from the organizations like, I don't know, the Bernie Sanders crew and
Our Revolution,
right? Yeah. You know, and I think they went for Otto. But Murphy was kind of coming in as a dark horse, and it was only about 2 months ago that we started hearing chatter that Murphy might take this thing. And the reason for that is because the way they do delegates on the DFL side, it's through walking sub-caucus, which you can listen to on episode
18
of Kip and Mac Save the World, how that works. But the kicker is Aaron Murphy. So Otto won the 8th in terms of governor delegates in the walking sub-caucus. But not all delegates are tied to a governor. They're tied to a candidate, and sometimes that candidate is at the congressional level. And so because it was a contested endorsement battle for 8, there were a lot of uncommitted governor delegates in the 8th, a lot of uncommitted governor delegates in the 2nd, and in the 1st. And so while Tim Walz could claim a huge delegate count coming out of the 1st, it wasn't all the delegates. And same in the 2nd, same in the 8th. And so when those people looked like they had the public momentum, Aaron Murphy and her team came in very smartly and grabbed those congressional candidate delegates and made them Aaron Murphy delegates. And that's how they got the chip lead in the delegate count, in a very, very simple, basic explanation of that.
All right, we'll have to continue this analysis when we come back. We're late for a break, and also get into what the primary is going to look like for both sides, especially the Democrats, because it's kind of crazy over there. When we return, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Kip and Max in studio with us. kipandmax.com is where you can check out their podcast. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Yeah, musical chairs, that is an apt metaphor for how things have been going, particularly with the DFL, almost exclusively with the DFL, out of their convention, their state convention that they had over the weekend, and the past 2 days since then. You know, today was the filing deadline for primary, and apparently it's, you know, dime a dozen in terms of who wants to run for what. And we're talking about with Kip and Max from the podcast Kip and Max Save the World here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We're streaming on TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Olin takes those calls and produces the show. We went out of the last segment with Kip giving us the rundown on how things were going for the gubernatorial endorsement at the DFL convention over the weekend. So pick up where you left off there, Kip.
Cool. Reintroductions. I am Kip. That is Max.
Hello.
Howdy. So picking up the fast pace where we left off, I saw someone post the meme of Forrest Gump getting interviewed at the end with his big beard on there. So Forrest, why are you doing this? Oh, I just like running. That's the DFL right now. So here we are. Convention just ended. Aaron Murphy got endorsed. There's a big jumping, bouncing around thing, and the convention trails off. So we start Sunday morning.
Hey, before we get into that,
yep.
One note. When it became apparent that Tim Walz was not going to get the endorsement,
yep.
Both him and Rebecca Otto, who had dropped out, began to push for a non-endorsement at the convention, no longer making the case to endorse Tim Walz.
Which is a huge no-no in
huge
the DFL,
mistake.
Far more than the GOP.
Well, even in the GOP, man, when you pay $110 a ticket, people are there to endorse a candidate.
This would have been the first time, I think, in the DFL ever that they didn't endorse a gubernatorial candidate. Like, doesn't happen.
So, significant choice on Tim Walz's part and Rebecca Otto's part.
Yep. So, Saturday's done. Sunday morning, Rebecca Otto doesn't even show up. No sighting. People thought that she was going to run for auditor in the Sunday auditor endorsement. That's why they set up the auditor for Sunday. In case she lost out on governor, she could run for auditor. Didn't happen. So we get into auditor. But also, because it was Aaron Murphy who had not picked a lieutenant governor candidate, potentially because she was trying to let people think, oh, I'm going to pick whoever your favorite person is, so also vote for me for president, and let people buy into the, oh, she's going to pick the greatest lieutenant governor pick.
Right.
Leaving that for Sunday. So they endorse for auditor. And they go with the blah thingy, right? But
name of actual person.
Blah.
And then they bring up the lieutenant governor endorsement, and Aaron Murphy walks Aaron May Quaid onto the stage.
Right. Who
ensue chaos.
If somehow you don't know, is one of the leftiest of the lefties in the House caucus. She's in the House, right?
In the House, yep. In the DFL House caucus.
And Metro, and she's a gay legislator, mm-hmm. and has been very outspoken on that front.
Yep.
Not going to play well outstate.
Yep. Super, super anti-gun. Yeah. Held the sit-in, blah, blah, blah. So we've got her, and a lot of people like the idea of the progressive left, but a lot of people realize that this is a bad electoral decision on a number of fronts.
Going back to our first conversation we had this evening.
Yep. Because it doesn't match where those conflicts align. This is a bad electoral decision because this throws 57A Apple Valley into chaos, utter chaos, because this has not been discussed with anyone. And that is a contested, tightly, tightly fought race. It was last cycle. She was the one Democrat to win in a wave of Republican victories in the House. Among the contested races, she was the one who won because she door knocked every single district in her district. By her account, twice. She just really worked for it. Anyway, so they pick her, throwing 57A into complete chaos. Now, this morning, well, Monday morning, DFL activists are all over saying, we had to pick up 11 seats, and now we have to pick up 12? So that's not even where it starts. We've got that one, which there's part of the problem, but now Walz is taking his CD1 people with him. And then Monday morning, Lori Swanson announces for governor. We now have Walz, Murphy, and Swanson running for governor, and Lori Swanson picks Rick Nolan from CD8, congressman from CD8, who was not running for re-election and had previously endorsed Walz.
And if you'll recall, this is the same Lori Swanson that dropped out of the attorney general endorsement process
early.
Early.
Right.
So all of a sudden, these pieces are coming together. Rick Nolan seems like he wants to retire, and then out of the clear blue sky...
Runs for LG.
Here we are.
So, we have CD8, CD1, both coalitions lining up behind their congressman, and you have the Metro coalition with other endorsement-friendly folks, because the way the DFL endorsement broke down, the delegate count was so heavily Metro because of how well Trump did outstate. Outstate really didn't have much of a voice. And so you've got Murphy and that ticket splitting these coalitions. The CD1 chair resigned. The CD3 chair resigned, DFL. The CD8 chair resigned.
Along with 19 BPOU leaders in CD8.
In CD8?
Just in protest?
Because they won't support the endorsed candidate because they're supporting the others.
Oh.
Taking the party operation and organization with them. And I'm not just talking about CD chair. CD1, there's like a half dozen other actual county chairs that resigned.
Right. Yeah,
sure. CD2, similar case. CD3, similar case. And they're taking these things with them. So I'm a little bit concerned in some ways because these individual folks are excellent campaigners. Murphy, Make Wade, Keith Ellison, who we're going to get to real quick here. All excellent campaigners. And that I respect because of their capacity in that way, apart from their policies. So they're kind of frightening from a campaigning side. But because when this all happened, it destroyed the base level foundation of the DFL turnout operation. Those precinct chairs are cultivated to know the people in the district and the influence networks over
These are the gears that turn your machine. Right.
Over years.
Yeah.
And that's where we have the popular hashtag that arrived, the hashtag DFL dumpster fire. Right. It literally was a dumpster fire until today, and it's still kind of a dumpster fire because then you have Keith Ellison abandoning his CD5 post.
Running for attorney general.
Running for attorney general.
Against the endorsed candidate.
Right, right.
And then backfilling that, you have everybody and their mother trying to take Keith Ellison's CD5 seat.
Including Ilhan, which throws 60B into chaos.
Yeah, Ilhan Omar. She's Somali, correct?
Somali, yes.
Yeah. First Somali.
Who's been the source of some degree of controversy during her term in the, in the House.
Well, she is incredibly popular, but then you also have Bobby Joe Champion who's running. You have Keith Ellison's ex-wife who's running.
Senator Torres Ray. They're all in it, and they're spreading out the field. And this is
for a primary.
And you have former Republican candidate Frank Drake running in the DFL.
DFL primary.
Nice.
It's a circus right now.
All right, that's where I want to pick up when we return is the Keith Ellison decision. I want to analyze it and look into what's happening, and I want to ask you guys a broader question about what this indicates about the shifting positioning of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in the state of Minnesota. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. KipandMax.com is the place to go for the podcast. Kip and Max Save the World. We're talking to those guys right now in studio. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
I'm just sitting in the studio just trying to get to you, baby.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. In studio with me, Kip and Max, their podcast, Kip and Max Save the World. And that's more than just clever marketing. What they mean by Kip and Max Save the World is that they try to end their episodes with a practical thought or suggestion, a solution, a course of action, something productive that can be done in an effort to save the world. And we're going to do the same thing here tonight on Closing Argument. But before we do, I have a question for you guys coming out of our discussion and analysis of all the news that came out of the DFL convention over the weekend. One of the metaphors that's been thrown about is musical chairs, because from moment to moment, you don't know who's running for what. And when the music stops, we don't know who the candidates are going to be for different things. That's now right. We do, because it's, you know, the filing deadline is.
Well, Erin McQuaid prefers to sit on the floor.
Yeah. So, yeah, she doesn't know how this game works, so she's going to lose. But the question that I have is, you know, because it's been characterized by us here and by a lot of folks online and even in the media as disarray. And, you know, you made the comment earlier that a lot of the, and I'm speaking to Kip now, that a lot of the DFL folks that you've personally talked to do not think of it in those terms. They don't think that this is. They didn't until Sunday. Okay. Well, then that puts a different spin on what I'm asking here. My question is the, because we previously talked about how the Republican convention was certainly relatively calm, cool, collected.
It went orderly, as expected.
Went as expected. The results were pretty much what we expected. There aren't a whole, the primary challenges that are coming were generally expected, particularly in the gubernatorial race. Is the reason for that difference really because there's some sort of substantive difference in organization between the parties, or is it possible that it has more to do with the fact that historically, statewide especially, the Democrats win here, and because they win here, there's a higher perceived value in securing these endorsements and winning these primary contests, because to do so is to be whatever it is you're running for. Like the presumption historically is, if you are the candidate on the ballot in November and D is next to your name and you're running for governor or state auditor or attorney general, you are going to win.
Well, in Minnesota, the Republican candidate for statewide office has not won the general after winning endorsement since Pawlenty. On the DFL side, Margaret Anderson Kelleher got endorsed for governor in 2010.
Right.
And Dayton came in the primary and beat her. So I don't think the endorsement on either side has really been that effective.
But to your point, Walter, there's no doubt. There's no doubt there's a bigger sense of urgency because there's a bigger recognition of the opportunity for
right.
those on.
And the DFL endorsement actually carries a lot more in terms of monetary support and actual organizational support, typically, although they just broke everything by losing their on-the-ground stuff in a number of ways.
To keep it real, so to speak, there are certain races on our side where you couldn't even, it was hard to find one person to
run.
Of
course. Sure. Of course. And we, in some of those races, we've stumbled into kind of golden opportunities because it has been a bloodbath up to this point. But to your point, there's no doubt that there's a bigger kind of hustle and bustle for these positions on that side of the aisle, because it's more of a reality for them that they're actually going to win these races. However, pay attention to Attorney General, because if Keith Ellison is running a statewide race, it's going to get real.
All right, let's wrap it up here real quick with your save the world moment here at the end of the program. How do we save the world based upon our topics this evening, Kip and Max?
I think the biggest way that, and Kip and I discussed it earlier today as we were recording our emergency broadcast podcast, recapping a lot of the same thing. Do not rest on your haunches if you are a Republican. Democrats in this state, especially, no matter how the primaries play out, no matter what a bloody battle it will be for them, they will coalesce around their candidates. It can be a dumpster fire, and we can have our fun right now and laugh about it. And we are. We're posting a lot of memes right now. But come August and after August, it's going to be the same old, same old. You know, you're going to have major money spent, and you're going to have a party coalesce around their candidate and act like none of this ever happened. So for us, I think we save the world by understanding that this is no different than any other kind of hard-fought election.
Right. The DFL versus the Republicans, we like to think about logically approaching policy, and then we very emotionally approach our endorsement and which candidates we get behind. And there is an extreme emotion there. On the DFL side, it's flipped. There's emotional approach to policy and logical approach to winning elections. When it actually comes down to who do we back in the general, everyone seems to come out and actually support the candidate that makes it through the primary and makes it through the endorsement.
KipandMax.com, the podcast, Kip and Max Save the World. Check it out. It's a good time. I've listened to it. It's definitely a type of analysis you're not going to hear elsewhere. Closing Argument is the name of this show. My name's Walter Hudson. 9 to 11 weeknights. Glenn Beck is next. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.